This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every daily supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify this program with my cool guests. And my guests today are John Dashback, the director of fantastic new documentary film, Come Back Anytime, and Wataru Yamamoto, the producer of the film. A mutual friend, Yukari Sakamoto, who is an influential food specialist based in Tokyo, introduced me to the new film, Come Back Anytime, or in Japanese, Mata Irasshai. It premiered at Doc NYC, which is the largest documentary festival in America, and at the ILC Center last month in November 2021. And I won't give away too much, but this documentary is about the ramen chef in Tokyo and the close-knit community of his regulars. And it sounds simple, but there are a lot to digest in your heart and mind. And I just suggest everyone watch it, especially in the current isolating social situation due to the pandemic. So today we'll discuss why John and Wataru decided to make a documentary about the tiny ramen shop in Tokyo, the profound messages they hope to convey to the audience through the film, how ramen can be instrumental in community building, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write to a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with John Dashback and Wataru Yamamoto. Hello, John. Hello, Wataru. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Hello. Hi. It's really great to speaking with you.
So after watching the film, I'm just speaking to my heroes, so let's begin. So first of all, to get to know you, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up? You may have eaten a lot of ramen, but...
Should I start? I could start. First, just thank you for that wonderful introduction. We really appreciate that you enjoyed the film, and we're hoping that that we'll be able to share it with a lot more people. So I grew up in New Hampshire in the U.S., Hanover, New Hampshire, which is home to Dartmouth College, which is a small town. It's a little bigger now, but it was a very small town when I grew up in. And I ate, I guess, what you'd call pretty typical kind of middle class American food of the 70s and 80s, but with a healthy perspective, because my parents were very health conscious, and so it was a lot of roasts and stews and casseroles and roast chickens and those kinds of things, and spaghetti night and taco night, which is all kind of a lot of Americans, I think, of my generation probably shared those kinds of things, but with real food mostly, and not a lot of sugar, and so it was a pretty healthy diet that I grew up on.
That was ahead of time, I think.
A little bit. Yeah, I think my mom was turned on to some progressive. She wasn't obsessive about it, but she was just very kind of health conscious. My father got really into tending his own garden. Which sort of resonated for me in the film, which maybe we'll talk about later.
What about you, Wataru?
Yeah, I'm from Kanagawa, next to Tokyo, and I grew up in a suburb. It's like New Jersey, sort of, I would say. And then my mom was a homemaker, so, she cooks almost every meal. And typical Japanese cuisine most of the time. So going to KFC or McDonald's was a fun going out activity, I guess. But, you know, I both enjoyed fish, sashimi, and steak, meat, yakiniku, whatever food offered. I didn't have like, you know, like, I was not a picky eater. So I was happy just to be served. And also, I've been, I really love ramen all my life. So I'm kind of really happy to be in a the producer of this movie.
Maybe that was a destiny.
Yeah, I didn't realize that, but maybe that is.
Right. And so let's get to know you even more. So tell us about your background. So how did you get into the film industry?
Well, I got into film through working in the industry on the production side from a pretty young age, and during summer breaks during college, I just always wanted to find a movie set to be on, and then I did a little of that before I decided to go to film school in New York at Columbia. So I studied there mostly screenwriting, but also editing. I really fell in love with editing there, and I had a great editing teacher there who you know, everybody has those teachers that they remember forever, and mine was definitely that experience at Columbia. So that's how I got into it, and kind of straddled both worlds of producing, working on other people's films, and making my own when I could find the time and the money. So that's sort of my history of getting into it.
Right, it's like a film is your whole life in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it has been. I've found other ways sometimes to support myself, but they're usually related to film or media, you know, consulting or you know, advertising and that kind of thing. So, when I make films, I try to be as independent as possible in doing them. And this one was completely independent, which was really fun. It was just my Japanese company. You know, we just financed it as we went, and we kept costs very low because it was basically a two-person crew, the two of us.
Right. Oh, that's awesome. And I have to say it's very successful. So, yeah. And Wataru, what about you?
Yeah. So I studied as an editor of a lifestyle magazine after graduating in college. And then I worked there for 4 or 5 years, and then I moved to New York and worked as a editor and writer of a U.S.-based publication. It's for Japanese living in U.S. So it's written in Japanese, but I got to interview like some, you know, Broadway stars or like restaurant chefs, and that was a really fun memory. And then after returning to Japan, Tokyo, I worked as a freelancer on both editor, writer for online or magazine or newspapers. And then I did a little bit of translation, interpretation, and this is actually my first sort of like a film project that I participated in, because I am a co-founder, co-president of the company that John created in Japan, and I kind of we've been doing on our own stuff up till this ramen movie. So it was a first, not only it was a first movie project for me, but also the first collaboration with John.
I kind of roped him into it.
Yeah, I had no choice, actually.
I said, okay. I need you. I can't do this on my own because my Japanese is not good enough. So,
well, that's another question. You know, like what you didn't say in my question or your answer to my question or your background is that what, when and how, like why did you go to Japan and how did you meet Wataru?
Yeah, we met, I mean, through in the New York years, and then we had a lot of mutual friends there, you know, some of whom were Japanese who I got to meet through Wataru, and they all kind of said, you know, you really, you, they just felt like there was something about me or my personality that would really click with Japan. So, so I decided to give it a try, and I thought I'd just go on a kind of a 3-month tourist visa and see what I could figure out. And I was sort of doing some freelance consulting. I was able to kind of do it from anywhere. And I did that a little bit of that back and forth until I realized I really should get a proper visa. And so, so that led to the company, that I set up to kind of, create an investor business manager visa that allowed me to stay there and work full time. And I fell in love with Japan, and I have been there for, I mean, it was on and off for a while, but it's almost now 10 years full time. So, I mean, you know, it's embarrassing how poor my Japanese still is, but I can understand it. I'm a lot better than I can speak it. So I kind of half knew what was going on as we were filming enough to be aware of kind of where to point the camera, but it really, I really relied on Wataru's, you know, a lot of his translations after the fact to really kind of dig into what we had. And actually he conducted, while I was shooting it, he was conducting the interviews that we had kind of prepared together, the questions, but he was conducting them, you know, in Japanese. So it was really collaboration in that sense.
Yeah. So he gave me, you know, like the notes beforehand, before the interview, like what he wanted me to ask, but he let me, and you know, have my own questions as well. And then being a journalist, writer can help me, was able to help definitely during those interviews, for the film. But one thing that's interesting, it was like, I'm so used to, you know, interviewing for the magazine or newspaper, so I got to be really vocal during the interview. Like when I'm listening, I said, "Oh, that's interesting," and ha ha ha. And then John has to tell me, like, "You have to be quiet, you know, like you don't overreact." And it was so hard for me to do that. In the end, I managed to do that, right, John?
Yeah, no, he learned it very quickly. But it was, yeah, that's something that you have to learn, just for the sake of the editing, obviously. You know, but his voice also appears at certain, you know, of important and kind of sometimes funny moments where he did ask follow-up questions, and I thought it was important, you know, to hear somebody asking. So you do get to hear his voice.
Well, I have to rewatch it to listen to what his voice.
That's great.
Right. And then what is the theme of the film Come Back Anytime or Mata Irashai in Japanese?
You know, I would say it's always hard for me, believe it or not, to characterize the theme. I have an intuitive sense of it, but I think the best way to put it was it's really about food and community and the intersection of food and community and how food can bring people together and create a community. I think that's what I saw about this place, and that's what motivated me to want to capture it and profile it. Was I just felt like there was this very unique community of people who had evolved around this very charismatic ramen master and this very cozy, wonderful place and this delicious food. So it's about, yeah, food and community. That's what I would say.
Right. So for listeners who have not seen the film, so who is Master Masamoto Ueda, the main character of the film?
He's a self-taught ramen master who's been running his own small ramen shop for over 40 years in Tokyo. It used to be a little bit bigger, and then he had to move. He lost the lease to his first place and had to move. And he talks about that a little bit in the film, but he's been at his current place for many years now. And it's a tiny little place with kind of 6 seats on the first floor and a couple tables upstairs. And he has this very loyal following of people, who some of whom have been coming for almost the those 40 years. And so he isn't, you know, sort of chasing any Michelin stars, and he's a very, very laid back guy, but he actually has created this incredible, delicious soup that people have come to kind of almost depend on for a lack of a better word, he's created this place of community that people gather at. He's very just charismatic and friendly and witty, and he's a great listener. He's sometimes a matchmaker. He's kind of a connector of people, and he really has become good friends with many of his customers. So it's just a very unique place, and he's a very unique guy. And I hope the movie gives people a sense of him and who he is.
Mm. Yeah, he is a really people person, I would say. So everybody can easily fall in love with him. And I'm sure Akiko, you will be in love with him as soon as you meet him. It's just like a really laid back. He's a really laid back, wholesome, really warm person that you want to go back to visit right after you leave the restaurant.
Right. So, I definitely Vicente is my list for my next visit in Tokyo. But he's he sounds like he's really like a god, like good person. But his past was not perfect, but he's refreshingly so simple, and it's just so charming, and it's just amazing that how you guys captured him. So, by the way, what kind of ramen does he serve?
Right. So actually, Wataru, do you want to take that one? You'll probably do a better job.
Yeah, so he started as just one ramen when he started opening in the late 70s. It was just soy-based ramen. And then that kind of evolved because of his regular demand. He added miso and shio based ramen as well. And then during the summer, he served cold hiyashi chuka-ish cold ramen as well. And then also, he has yaki gyoza and su gyoza, fried dumpling and dumpling with soup. That's the basic menu of Vicente, and
that's almost it, right? I mean,
so it's really limited in a way, and people who love to Vicente's ramen, the signature I would say is the shoyu ramen, because that's the one he's been serving from the day one of his restaurant place. And
what I would add is the chashu too is kind of a big part of his signature dish. I mean, it's a topping for everything he serves, but then he has one that's just chashu ramen, and it's extra chashu. And I think there, for some people, it's myself included, it's one of the things that people crave the most, because it's a unique chashu.
Yeah. That's true. And then back to the soy ramen, soy sauce ramen. It's for Japanese, for us, for most of us, it's kind of remind me of the old days, like simple soy sauce ramen is the most nostalgic ramen for us. In Kyushu, the tonkotsu is big, and in Hokkaido, miso is and shio are also very big. But for most of Japanese, soy ramen is a sort of the nostalgic old time ramen, and Vicente represents that. So I prefer, for my last dying they I would love to have soy ramen, Vicente soy ramen, choy ramen.
Wow. Yeah. That's a big statement. Wow. Yeah, and then there's so many scenes that, you know, customers, regular customers just squill their eyes, then they just shut up and just focus on the flavors. So yeah. Yeah, and then best for listeners who are not familiar with the chashu is like you know, roasted pork on top of ramen. Mm. And it's kind of a test of ramen chef skills, right? To prepare the perfect pork, because usually it can be a little like a stinky dryer. But Vicente's chashu looks like a fine dining, really carefully prepared topping of the ramen.
Yeah, it's very unique, and in the film he goes into some detail about he and others, you know, in sort of characterizing it. But what he says is he didn't like the typical chashu, so he had to find a chashu that he could eat himself. Because he another thing, just on the side, is that he and his wife, who comes to help with the lunch rush, they eat it every day. They have for 40 years. That's their lunch. You know, I think so. He said, I got to have something that I can eat. I mean, or that he can love. You know, so he kind of experimented, and he said his inspiration was actually his wife's kakuni pork. So the pork belly, that's very fatty, and it's simmered for a very long time. I mean, you know, Akiko, you could probably describe that dish better than I can, but the gist is it's that's inspired by that, but it's actually a pork back rib, which is not the typical cut of meat for a lot of chashu either. So it's a unique style of meat, and it's cooked in the soup, and then in the later in soy, and then the soy becomes the tare for the soy-based ramen. So it's infused with a lot of that pork meat flavor and fat. So the two are kind of influencing each other, and it kind of goes in a circle in a way, taste-wise. So that's one of the really great things about it too.
Right. Yeah, it's like definitely it's not just the community and the chef; it's all about food as well. So
right.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, the Kazuko, the chef. Masamoto Ueda's wife, she is a great character too. So I was really fascinated, especially later in the film, she was featured also. And it's such a fascinating couple as well, and how they work together, how they take care of each other. And another part of the big part of the film was the existence of a supportive wife, Kazuko.
Yeah, it was important to me that we really include that, you know, and we shot way more footage than we could use. And occasionally we thought, you know, there's a really sort of a chapter on her, but we thought, well, you know, you could take it out and it wouldn't be missed per se, but we really felt like it needed to be there just to tell what we knew was the full story, because really they're a team, and his success that he's had with this place is fundamentally dependent on that partnership that they've had over the years, and you know, she is there every day with him serving the busy lunch, and then she's, you know, also a homemaker and raising three children, and you know, so it was important. But then what I found most interesting about when we did sit down and talk to her was she has a pretty serious hobby of painting, and she got into that pretty late in life because she realized that she needed you know, she wanted to have something that was just her own and not sort of tied to him in that place. And I mean, we haven't gotten into this, but a lot of the film is also about what he does on the weekends with his customers, and goes out. He just can't sit still. So he's out kind of traipsing around the countryside, digging up interesting wild foods. And so she used to join him on that, but I think at a certain point she kind of decided she wanted to have her own thing, so she picked up painting, and she's actually an amazing painter. So that became a kind of a revelation that we discovered as the film progressed that we wanted to cover, and she had a small exhibition, so we got to film there and show that part of her.
Right. By the way, how, you know, I know that you knew the ramen shop, small ramen shop in Tokyo, but how did you come up with the idea of making the film about the ramen chef and the tiny ramen shop?
You know, it was really this place. You know, it wasn't, I didn't say I want to make a movie about a ramen shop, let me go find one. I found myself in this place. So Wataru's good friend works in the neighborhood and was a regular there. And he one weekend one week just said, hey, we're going to go wild mountain yam foraging this weekend with the ramen master of my favorite local ramen place, or the ramen place near his office where he goes for lunch. He said, would you be interested in coming? And I said, absolutely. You know, I don't know what that is, but it sounds really interesting. So that's how it started, actually. And that was about, I don't know, 8 years ago. And they were just very welcoming to me, and he and his gang, we went up to the mountains, and we did it again in the film. But the first time we went, you know, we all went and kind of camped out in this field near a charcoal making hut that was also very fascinating. So it was through that context that I was invited to come meet the master. And that's when I first had the ramen. So Wataru and his friend and I, I'm really, you know, have to thank Wataru and his friend for introducing me to this place. And then I wouldn't say I was a regular, but I kept going there. And I was there at some moments when I felt like I was getting a real sense of what a unique place this was. There was a year end party right before he closed for about 10 days over the holidays, and there was a professional violist as one of the regulars, and she appeared late that night, the last night, and it was really crowded. Everybody was there to get their last bit of their favorite ramen before he closed for a little bit, and it was just a very jolly and joyous atmosphere, and everybody convinced her to serenade them on her viola, and it really moved me, and I just thought I had been wanting to do something in Japan and make a film. I wasn't really ready to make a fiction film. Previously I'd made fiction films, but I think it just hit me that night. I was like, okay, this is this place. This place is really unique. He's really unique. Could I possibly capture that and convey it to an audience? So that was really always the goal. It was just like, can I let people experience this place vicariously through the film? And that was the aim. And that's what it became.
That actually reminds me of, you know, the Netflix Midnight Diner in Japanese, Shinya Shokudo. Mm-hmm.
Love that show.
Like, it's just almost every part of it, especially that the year end part, there's an episode.
Right.
How people gather, and then every year they did that kind of very close in community.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's really close. And by the way, my friend who introduced us to Vicente, he's in the movie. He's the guy who didn't like, who doesn't like Negi Scarion, and that's so that he can have his salt-based ramen, because he features Negi there. So you will know who my friend is in the movie.
And he's there. He goes. So we went digging up bamboo shoots, and he was the student of some of these countryside excursions. He was there learning how to dig up bamboo shoots and learning how to dig up the wild mountain yams. And so there is this sense also, I think, where the master is. He wants to teach the younger generation some of these somewhat old-fashioned countryside activities that he grew up doing, but that he wants his kind of city-dwelling customers to be able to experience as well. So, yeah, he's in quite a bit of the film, actually.
Right. Well, he is a very big, bright personality, but he doesn't seem to enjoy huge attention on the big screen. So how did you convince him to star in the film?
It's interesting. I was that you would say that. What I'm curious just what makes you, what gave you that impression that he didn't like the attention? Is that just the sense you got watching it?
Yeah, I think he is more into paying attention to what he has, and he's not ambitious to expand or like you said, he's not shooting for the stars, like Michelin star restaurant or anything like that.
Right. He is not somebody who would have sought out, somebody to, hey, somebody should make a movie about me. On the contrary. Yeah, I see what you mean. I think he enjoyed the process of us being around filming. And he's not camera shy, although it was interesting because if we ever tried to ask him to do something or repeat something, he suddenly became very self-conscious. So he was able to be completely natural if he was doing his thing that he's been doing for 40 years. But if I ever wanted to get a different angle, I said, "Oh, could you just do that from the opposite side or the opposite hand?" He just couldn't do it.
He suddenly became like a robot, that was really weird,
Just freeze up. Yeah. But we were nervous, so after that moment that I had, it was kind of a New Year's resolution, I guess. And so we were right back there by the time he reopened on like January 4th, that next year. We were there the first day and we kind of waited until it got slow and we were very nervous and we approached the subject. We were ready to have him just go, "Oh, I don't think so." And then we were, okay, how are we going to convince him would have been the next step. But he just said, "Oh, that sounds fun. Yeah, sure. Let's do that." and that was that easy. I mean, it's not all films or getting access is not always that easy, but I think it was also because we already knew him pretty well. We had been to he has these pizza parties for his regulars at his country garden. He goes fishing. We had been fishing with him. So I think there was a certain amount of trust that we were going to do something interesting and also not sort of, make him look like a fool or anything. And so he got into it pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I think he was really happy that we said not only inside of the ramen restaurant, but we told him that we want to go follow his outdoor activity. So he was just so happy that younger guys are coming following me all year round. That's great. I think that was his sort of like big reason to say yes. And also I remember that I told him that even though John wants to make a film of this place and you, he doesn't know what the result's gonna be like. And then I think that time his answer was, that doesn't matter. At least he can come up with something that I can, play at my funeral, right? And then that was like a big joke and big release for us. So it was much easier than we thought. And then we were really happy and absolutely happy about that.
It definitely lowered the stakes for us. Remember, it just has to be good enough for my funeral. But at first we really didn't know what it was going to be, and that's partly my inexperience as my first documentary. But it was kind of willful, it was a choice to just capture as much as we could. And I guess maybe because I was kind of trying to capture a feeling, and I thought, well, I just have to be there a long enough time that enough happens and we have to talk to enough people. So we did a lot of interviews with the regulars, but we did say, like, can you give us a year? Not that he was contractually obliged to let us stick around, but if he could commit, in theory to that, to letting us, just so he understood the scale of what we were thinking, because we really wanted to capture as much of the place as we could, and at different times of year as well. And that became an important part because a lot of what he does on the weekends is seasonal, really just seasonal foods and seasonal activities. So, so we knew we were going to need a good amount of time. And then by the end of it, he said, I'm lonely. When you go, you know, he said, why don't you guys come out with me again? And we said, well, because now we have to edit the film.
Yeah, he's been saying lately, like, you guys have abandoned me.
Right.
Well, I don't know, because you might do a sequel, hopefully. The way he accepted the offer of the film, I really think is, as he is, he's open, and he navigates his life very well, because he has many challenges, which is depicted in the film too. Mm. But he just acts before he thinks too much and move on and find a way to just navigate. And maybe inspiring to me. You know, we tend to think too much, but he's like, all right, why not, and just move on. So
absolutely, likewise. And I learned a lot from him by watching that, you know, that he'll try anything. I mean, he's, you know, there's so much that we couldn't fit in the film, but he had a baseball team, you know, on the weekends for a while, and he ran a marathon, and you know, he's just somebody who wants to try anything. So I think that's a big part of why he said yes so quickly. He's like, oh wow, I'll be in a movie, sure, you know, but like you said, he wasn't seeking, you know, some kind of validation for his culinary skills. You know, because I think he already is very comfortable and confident in where he's at in his life and his career, that he doesn't need to prove anything to anyone. So it was more just, I think he thought, and like what Haro said, I think he thought it'd be fun just to have an excuse to go do all these things. So I think that year was a very active year for him, because he kept saying, well, how about this? Will you want to go do this? You want to go do this? Let's go pick carrots and feed them to horses. That's something I always do, you know, in September or whatever. You know, it was just, he was always ready to, and so we just said yes to everything.
Yeah.
And we ended up with a lot more footage than we could use. So we're trying to work that into some bonus scenes, actually.
Yeah, he made my job really easy as a producer, because he arranged everything for us. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I called this guy and that for this excursion, so you don't have to worry about that. And he was quick and articulate. And so maybe we should have credited him as a co-producer.
Yeah, transportation coordinator too. He was always like, okay, here's who's driving. You're going to be in this car. You're going to be. But he was always doing that anyways when they would go on these expeditions, you know, these excursions. So, but he did make it easy for us.
Interesting. So it's a collaboration. Totally.
Definitely. It really is. Yeah. I mean, it was.
Okay. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss the messages John and Wataru wanted to communicate through the film. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Saki Kotema, and my guests today are John Dashback, the director of fantastic new documentary film, Come Back Anytime, or Mata Irashai in Japanese, and also Wataru Yamamoto, the producer of the film. So what are some of the biggest messages that you wanted to convey to the audience through the film?
I would say, I mean, I touched on this earlier, but it was. I sensed that there was something unique about this place, and it was something that I admired. And so for me, it was as much a process of discovering that, you know, as telling it. You know, it was finding, figuring out what it was that attracted me to it. And I think what I discovered was that that this community existed because of this combination of his personality and the openness of the customers to engage with him in a kind of a community, building a community together. So I think, you know, the message is also, I mean, we touched on it a little bit because I think the pandemic influenced this a little bit, because I was editing kind of in the midst of the most uncertain time, which was sort of mid 2020. And I think if there's a message, it's appreciate these kinds of communities, you know, when you can, and cherish them and try to keep them together, because the pandemic certainly came along and disrupted a lot of communities like this, and this one as well, although it's you know, it's bounced back, but I think it's when you have something special like this, appreciate it and cherish it, and if you don't, maybe go find it, because this is a, you know, such an important aspect of life is having a community to share it with.
Yeah, and let me add that as Japanese, I kind of saw that he is a good example of, you know, he's not a typical Japanese, like the outside of Japan thing, like us being, you know, always serious and so on. And also because of the Jiro of Sushi or Ramen Head, you know, Japanese chefs are usually portrayed as like a, you know, serious chef, always thinking about their food and their dishes and creation. And even over the weekend, they go out to study and to capture, to get some inspiration, stuff like that. But not all the chefs are like that, you know, like they have their outside of life, of their restaurant. And then Ueda-san is a good example of this. So I wanted to convey that message, that was my hope.
Mm. Right. Yeah. I mean, I would just add that you know, I did sort of see this as a film for a foreign audience. That was partly my message was, here's a glimpse of what I've experienced as a foreigner in Japan, which might not be what you're getting through typical media depictions of Japan. Although, you know, like the Shinya Shokudo, the Midnight Diner, is a great fictionalized version of the kind of cozy izakaya life. So it certainly represents that. But it's all just, you know, anime and sushi and like what I said, kind of obsessive, super hyper serious chefs. That there's a lot of fun, laid back experiences as well. And I think as a foreigner, I wanted to express that as well to foreign audiences.
You guys are very successful in all those communicating the messages, because I really felt that, you know, the chef as well as the regulars are really taking care of each other, right? Mm-hmm. And interviewees, regulars, interviewees are really so grateful to what the master did to them. And I was so envious. I really wish I could live there, like right next to the place, and I can go there every night. So
yeah, some of them do. Yeah, some of the ones, yeah, and they're featured in the film. And I'm a little jealous of them too, because it takes me like a half an hour to get there. So oh. I would you know, definitely be there more frequently. Although that's not too bad. But yeah, the ones who live just around the corner, they're there almost every night. It's their local, you know, it's their local hangout. And sometimes even if he'll say, "Oh, the noodles are all gone," and they'll just stay and have a drink and a snack of some wakame, you know, seaweed or some pickles or an egg, you know, just some of his little sumami side, you know, dishes. It's not only even only about the ramen, particularly at night. I mean, that was another aspect of this place that I found so unique, is that it's really like a ramen izakaya. It's not the only one. There certainly are other places like that, but it was kind of unique in that way, that it had evolved into this place that is as much a local bar as it is a ramen shop. So that also became really interesting to me.
So what was the biggest challenge in making the film?
I'd say for me, it was keeping up with him. I mean, even though he's, you know, I'm 20 years younger than him almost. You know, he's so active and he has so much energy that was just on a practical, from a practical point of view, that was one of the challenges for me, because I was filming it myself. It was also the first time I attempted to be, you know, my own cinematographer, and that was really out of necessity, rather than just because I thought I could do a particularly good job at it. I just realized that I had to do as good a job as I could, because it's such a small place. So that, I guess, would be another aspect of what was really challenging was fitting. I'm, you know, 6'3", and I'm not a small guy, and so this is a pretty tiny space, and so just fitting in there and not breaking anything was also a big concern. But creatively, I think it was finding the structure and the way to tell the story, given that I had just kind of just shot anything and everything I could for a year. It was really that I suddenly sat down. It really took me a while, and I kind of avoided it for a while, just because I wasn't really sure how do you take all that and put it into the format that an audience can sit in a movie theater and feel like they've had a kind of a cohesive experience that has a beginning, middle, and end, and all that. So that was the other, I would say, biggest challenge for me.
What about you, Wataru?
So I was really worried that he would break something at the restaurant, because you know, he went inside of the kitchen, and you know, it was really narrow, and I was so nervous, like, oh, what if he knocked over some precious his soy tare or miso tare, and then luckily it didn't happen, so I was really relieved. But when we visited him a couple of months ago, I actually knocked over his precious miso tare.
Oh, no.
He was really
so relaxed about it, though.
Yeah. Like, oh, it happened, right? And then he was so casual and forgivable. So I was really relieved. But anyway, that was my big concern during this shoot. And
Right. And also, what was the most rewarding part of making the film?
I think it was, for me, it was getting to know him, like I said, you know, and even more than I, because I felt like I knew enough about him that I wanted to make a film about him. But what I discovered was, you know, that he's even more interesting and complex than I knew, and just so open, which is, you know, not always easy to find, particularly among, you know, some Japanese people. He was such an open book, and he was willing to, he had no qualms about talking about, you know, we alluded to his you know, he got into some trouble as a wayward youth, you know, and this was, you know, in some ways, kind of his saving grace was finding this passion and the focus of running this restaurant. He was definitely aimless for a while, and but I think, you know, getting to know him to the degree that we did by focusing on him and just learning so much from him. And I think also just getting to know the regulars pretty well as well, because we spent so much time there and we really, you know, enjoy being able to hang out with them. And you know, also what we spent time in cars, you know, traveling and camping with some of them and just getting to know that whole gang of people. It's just a really nice bunch of people who are fun to hang out with and who are funny and generous. And I guess also all the food we got to eat. that would be the other big reward was we just, you know, he was constantly feeding me, both of us really with all the treats that we were foraging or making or finding.
Right. Or what about you? What, anything to add?
Yeah, I know I should say something different, but I have to say the same thing with John. Like, it's you know, the friendship we had with the master and his regular, just something precious. Like, I will treasure the rest of my life.
Right. And then, you know, you guys are a duo of American and Japanese. So how did the different cultural perspectives contribute to making such a great film?
I would say for me, I think I really relied, well, I relied on a practical level on you know, Watara's interpretation, you know, skills and his ability to help me understand, you know, better than I could myself what was going on in front of me, but also I guess in terms of, you know, cultural perspectives, I think it was I was fortunate to have his guidance in terms of you know, what was okay to do and is it okay to ask this? And, you know, when we were making that list of questions, you know, we don't want to offend anybody, you know, it was particularly him. So I think to have somebody who's kind of who was a touchstone for cultural boundaries and guidance in terms of me not just being a bull in a china shop as a filmmaker was one of the great things. And then we did the subtitles ourselves. So I mean, Watara did most of them, and then I kind of just said, you know, I think in English maybe you could say it like this. As a native English speaker, but that collaboration was actually really was really fun and rewarding and but also challenging.
Right. So you didn't miss anything and nothing lost in translation.
I hope not. You know, it's funny because I was working with transcripts and there were times where I misunderstood the transcript and I was, you know, a little too confident in my own Japanese and there were times where I thought I knew what it was, and then I included it and I thought I was trying to sort of convey something that would be like, that's not really what they're saying, you know. So there was a lot of arounds of that too, so he was very, very crucial in the editing phase too of kind of fine-tuning it and making sure that it was conveying and saying what I thought it was, you know, or meant it to be.
Oh, thank you for the acknowledgement, John. because how many hours did you shoot? Oh,
well, I mean, it wasn't all translated, but we shot something like 80 hours. I mean, it was just, you know, it's crazy, you know, for an 81 minute film, which is not, you know, I guess it's not uncommon for documentaries to have a very large shooting ratio of footage to what you use. But we shot, well, you know, probably 20 interviews with regulars that were each an hour long, and it was a lot of transcription. He did it. He made the upstairs of Vicente his office for a period of months there. He would just sit up there transcribing, and then feed them over to me in the editing room.
So we have a lot of footage that we were not able to include in this movie, and so whoever interested in this movie and want a sequel or extended version, just reach us because we can make it happen. Also, I want to add that this movie is John's. It's made through his own eyes, so I don't think this movie can make made from, I would say, any Japanese directors. And then my role was just to make it happen and just be, you know, helpful as much as I could. And I'm kind of happy that I was able to provide what he needed. That's all.
For sure.
Okay. And then you presented the film at the Doc NYC, which is the largest documentary festival in America, and also at the IOC Center in November, along with other many other places I heard. So how did the audience react at each viewing event?
Yeah, it's interesting because of the pandemic. So we actually premiered the film last April at Hot Docs in Canada, which is North America's largest documentary film festival. But we didn't get to experience it with an audience because they were on lockdown there. So the whole thing was virtual. So we were just kind of experiencing it vicariously from Tokyo. And we kind of encouraged people to sign up to our mailing list. And so we would see, we kind of got a sense that, okay, somebody must have watched it because they just signed up. But it wasn't until Doc NYC at the IFC Center, that's their one of their venues, they showed it, you know, two screenings we did there that we actually saw it with an audience for the first time. It showed in Melbourne, Australia in August, but that was also during a lockdown. And, you know, this was actually the first time either of us were able to travel outside of Japan since the beginning of the pandemic, this November. So I think for both of us, you know, it was a really unique experience just suddenly to see it in a room full of people, because we really never had. And even though it had shown in quite a few festivals already, so we were really grateful, first of all, to Doc NYC for choosing it and including it in their lineup. And then just to have the opportunity to see it and to hear people react, where they laughed and that kind of thing. And particularly what they just audibly reacted to is always great. I was sitting in the back, what I'd love to do is just sit on stage and watch people watch the film, but that's just a little too weird, I think. but so I didn't get to see their faces as they watched it, but at least we got to sort of hear people respond, and it's always neat to experience that.
Did you see any difference between a Japanese audience and an American or non-Japanese audience in terms of reactions?
Well, we haven't seen it with a Japanese audience yet, believe it or not, because we were almost ready to, and then Japan sort of went through these waves where just when it seemed like things were okay, we'd be thinking about having at least a friends and family screening at a theater that we found, things would kind of shut down again. And that happened through all of last year up until right before we left for New York. So things are actually kind of at a point where we probably could, you know, without being irresponsible, you know, convene a large group of people for a screening. And we just sort of didn't want to do that. So we're still looking forward to that. You know, we don't know what the Japanese response will be.
I think maybe it shouldn't, because Byzantine is going to be bombed. I'm serious. But my only concern about Byzantine is that after the film, it must be a kind of destination, although many people cannot go to Japan freely due to the pandemic. But how is Byzantine doing? Is any more people coming? And it's already busier than...
My sense is that it's kind of business as usual. The people who know about it know, but I don't know that our film has had enough exposure to really influence the Japanese, customer base. I do think that maybe one fringe benefit of having made the film is that it's making him, at least, not that he was thinking about closing, but now he's definitely wants to wait until he has a chance to meet some foreign people who have seen the film. I think he's really looking forward to that possibility and hope. And he loves meeting people from all different cultures and, you know, all over the world. And so I think the idea of a bunch of people who coming just because they saw the film would be exciting to him and thrilling to him, you know. So I think he's eagerly awaiting them, but I think it'll be a little bit longer. Maybe hopefully 2022 there'll be some opening up a little bit for tourism again. And if that's the case, I think he'll be waiting.
Yeah. So then where can our listeners watch the film, come back anytime, and eventually go visit Vicente sometime next year?
So we don't have, so your listeners in the U.S., we will have more distribution in the U.S. It was just briefly available through DocNYC online throughout the U.S., but just for that window of the festival. So we're working on finding, you know, other distribution possibilities, including the possibility of a small theatrical release. So I think the best way, I mean, if you have listeners in Australia, it is in theaters there coming early next year, and also in Taiwan. It's opening in theaters in Taiwan and on December 24th. But as far as the US and North America, we're still working on that. So the best thing, if people who are intrigued and might want to see the film, would be to go to our website, comebackanytime.com, and join the mailing list. It's I like to call it a non-spammy mailing list. We use it very sparingly. We won't bombard you with ramen trivia, but we use it to let people know. We ask them to give us their country and zip code, just so that we can kind of target, say, hey, you know, it's available now in the U.S. in case you want to see it. So that's the best way to find out about it.
Yeah, we have listeners, surprisingly, in 190 countries worldwide. Wow, so, yeah, hopefully everyone can go check comebackanytime.com and then sign up for the newsletter and get updated. And I think really a lot of people, everybody should watch it. And I watched it right before I went to bed. I had a good dream, like very relaxing, happy dream. So
that's great to hear.
Yeah. So it's my final question. So what are your plans and dreams?
Well, I would, in the short term, I would like as many people as possible to see this film, for sure. You know, we both, I think, would like that. And then for me, it's to make, just keep making more films. Probably, you know, ideally in Japan. I have made fiction films before, so the idea of making a fiction film is daunting, but maybe is would be a good challenge. Although there are many other aspects of Japanese culture that I personally would love to explore, and also try to give my perspective as an outsider who's inside Japan, sort of to the rest of the world, of just a slightly maybe different perspective than what a lot of mainstream, you know, they're experiencing in other media forms. So that's my goal. Wataru, how about you?
So the master already has asked me to be at his restaurant, Vicente, when all foreigners come after watching our documentary, Come Back Anytime, because he designated me as his a helper, but also as an interpreter over there, so that he doesn't have to worry communicating with foreign visitors. But I just think, you know, with him, I don't think any English or foreign language speaking is necessary. He can just sort of communicate by heart, and then with anybody. So I think he doesn't speak English, but and whoever wants to visit Vicente but worry about not being able to communicate in Japanese, there's no worry. Somehow your experience will be really good, and then the regulars or whoever happened to be there be helpful, and it's going to be a once in a lifetime experience. So when I'm available, obviously I want to be there and then to experience and help for him as much as possible. So I guess that's my plans and dream.
And my other goal is to rope him into producing another one for me, which he's on the fence about, but I'm hoping that I can get him to produce yet another one.
Okay. Well, I look forward to that. So, But there, don't tell him that, because I would spend it as any minute, more minute as possible with him. He's just an amazing person, right?
Yep.
So, yeah. So thank you so much for joining us today, John Wataru. So good luck.
Thank you.
And keep me posted. I mean, I'm really hoping you guys are going to create a sequel. So
thank you. Yeah.
Thank you
for having us. And I'm so glad to hear you enjoy the film. It's great speaking with you about it.
Thank you. You are really easy to talk to. So we really...
because you guys are easy to talk to.
Oh, thank you. So, and then let's come. I mean, when you come to Tokyo, just let us know. We'll take you there.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's going to be my list. So I can't wait to go to Japan.
Great.
So thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikukatayama.com. Japan Needs is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Anand Spenjan, and we'll take a winter break for the next few weeks. So we'll see you in the new year. Have a wonderful rest of 2021 and Happy New Year.
Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.